How can you grow and flourish through adolescence, midlife, and beyond? That's what we're going to explore today with Mary Pfeiffer on Your Life in Process. 25 years ago, I read a book called Reviving Ophelia, Saving the Selves of Adolescent Girls by Mary Pfeiffer. It was a pretty instrumental book in my adolescence. It changed the way that I saw myself, saw my struggles. I felt seen and normalized and non-pathologized. Mary Pfeiffer has written a number of influential books, books that have really changed our paradigm. She looks at culture and how culture and context influences human experiences. She's a clinical psychologist and has written 11 books, including Letters to a Young Therapist, which is now used for training therapists, Seeking Peace, Chronicles of the Worst Buddhist in the World, which talks about her experience of midlife, Women Rowing North, which is about redefining aging. And her newest book is A Life in Light, Meditations on Impermanence. She's an activist, very involved in environmental issues. And throughout her career as a clinical psychologist, she's tackled issues that she's trying to figure out for herself. Everything from how she responded to her mother's death, to how she dealt with a midlife meltdown, to aging. And I was surprised to find when I was reading David Brooks' book on how to know a person that he referenced Mary a number of times. And it made me pull out my old copy of Reviving Ophelia, read through it, and reach out to her to see if we could have a conversation. It's a real honor to talk to someone like Mary Pfeiffer, who's had such an impact on the field of psychology, on education. Every life stage that we face gives us a little bit more than we can handle. And it's in stepping into that, choosing growth and building our skills that strengthens us as we grow up. Certainly, you probably felt that during adolescence. If you have an adolescent or work with adolescents, you can see how this stage just gives them a little bit more than they can handle and how in moving through it, they develop skills that they'll need for the next stage. In today's conversation, I talk with Mary about reviving Ophelia. We talk about the midlife meltdown, and we talk about what's to come, the beauty of aging, and what it feels like to have enough time to do the things that you enjoy. Enjoy this conversation with Mary, and on the other side, I'll share with you some of the specific strategies that she mentions.
Reviving came out in 94. And just to refresh your memory and the listeners' memory, that was before school shootings, before 9/11, before personal computers, before cell phones. So many things were different at that time. And girls were very angry at their parents because the prevailing theory at that time was if you have a teenager in trouble, it's because you're in a dysfunctional family. And girls believed it, and their parents believed it. And meanwhile, the girls I was seeing in my office, my daughter was in high school too, so I was seeing her friends. And most of them are coming from very good families, the kind of families that will want to do everything they can to facilitate their daughter's growth and overall mental health. And what I realized was these girls were blaming their parents, but their misery wasn't coming from their parents. Their misery was coming from school. My daughter, for example, would wake up pretty cheerful in the morning and just come home grumpy as hell. The other thing was this was the era of MTV, and girls were starting to feel extremely insecure about their bodies. So I wanted to write about what I felt was a dysfunctional culture. And I was uniquely suited for that because my undergraduate degree was in cultural anthropology. And I was very interested in how culture affects personality. And then in psychology, I was very interested in how personality is shaped by culture. So looking at teenage girls in therapy through the lens of culture just came very natural to me. And it actually, I take a lot of pride in this. It changed the paradigm. Some for psychology and for the way everyone thought about teenage girls. Now, I wasn't the only one. Gilligan was out there. She did a beautiful job. There were some other people writing about girls. But my daughter and I updated and revised Reviving Ophelia. And one thing we did was we sent out copies of the old Reviving to girls all over the country and smart girls and readers who we knew would make a commitment and keep it. And we told them, go through this book cross out everything that's boring, no longer relevant, that you don't want to read. And on the other hand, write in the margins all through the book what you want to know more about. So we got rid of a lot of material and we added a lot of material. The main thing girls wanted to hear about was social media. Social media, social media. That's what they wanted to hear about. Also, in the original book, believe it or not, there was not a chapter on anxiety. But many of the girls that we corresponded with by the time we published the 25th year edition were actually extremely anxious, highly anxious, panic attacks, lot of anxiety around school shootings, a lot of anxiety around academics. In many cases, girls weren't leaving the house very much. A lot of social anxiety, like just simple things like the idea of going out for a cup of tea with a friend made them too anxious. So one of the big differences 25 years later, girls were primarily staying home in their bedrooms with their devices watching Netflix on a Saturday night. But here's a positive thing. The girls in the more recent time loved their mothers. They often described their mothers as their best friends. And the change in tone around family was so different. And I hypothesize that the difference is the world has gotten much harder and meaner, and that girls really trust and need their families in their corner by now.
There's also a cultural shift that's happened because of Reviving Ophelia, that the mothers of those adolescents were the adolescents who had mothers that read Reviving Ophelia.
That's right.
I'm one of them. You know, like right now at this point, you know, we have adolescent children.
That's right.
And when I was a sophomore in high school, your book came out. And I remember being in therapy and my mom just being so frustrated with feeling like feeling blamed. I had anorexia, really feeling blamed for my anorexia. And she carried a tremendous amount of guilt about it. And she was also a middle school teacher. And she went to a talk by you. And it changed the way that she saw herself as a parent and also saw these adolescent girls. So there's a shift that happened as a result of Reviving Ophelia that now we just don't think about adolescent struggles in that way anymore, that it's the mother's fault or it's the family's fault or that it's the adolescent's fault, that there's something wrong with them, that
right,
they're struggling.
Right.
So a lot's changed, but there's also a through line that is very much the same of this. I mean, that your subtitles are always good, like saving the selves of adolescent girls, that there's a self that gets lost during the vibrant girl that's out climbing trees and picking flowers and making up stories somehow changes during those adolescent years. And the lessons that you teach in Reviving Ophelia are timeless in a lot of ways. So tell us a little bit about that. Like if we think about the coping skills for resilience, what is necessary during that time of adolescence?
Yeah. Well, one thing that you're referring to is the book is really developmental psychology too, isn't it?
Right.
And it's about the ways people 13 and 14 years old think. And so one of the things I talked about in Reviving Ophelia is how necessary it is to have a North Star and some sense for where you want to go, what kind of person are you, what are your values, what you find meaningful, what kind of people would you have your friends. So those are all sort of under the category of knowing yourself and building a self through. One of the great things you can do in therapy, as you know as a therapist, is help people build a self. Help people tell positive stories about who they are. Help people become richer and deeper in their sense of understanding of the world and moral imagination. Then another set of skills is really, we could call it emotion management. And that is everything from rating your stress to having reasonable expectations to self-calming skills, understanding how to calm down, to perspective skills. I won't always feel this way, tomorrow I'll feel different. Or as I told one girl, you won't always be trapped in the halls of a junior high. Life is long and you'll be out of middle school before you know it. Yeah. So those are really important. Then a lot of stuff about social skills, you know, how to relate to people, how to be a good friend, how to listen, how to stand up for yourself, how to have boundaries, the power of yes, the power of no, how to make decisions about the kind of people you want to be with, how to make sexual decisions. I mean, I don't know a lot right now about what's happening with sexual decision-making in the schools. You would be much more of an expert in this age group than I am. But I do know that there's kind of two poles. And one is a sort of a sex is so weird and scary right now, I'm staying away from it, you know, and maybe when I'm in college or maybe I'll wait till I get married. I mean, it was very surprising to me how much more abstemious girls are now than they were in the mid-90s. I mean, I remember in the mid-90s, girls would say things like, well, I just want to do it and get over it.
Yeah.
I don't think girls are saying that so much now. And then on the other hand, there's a great deal of sex without relationship now. And that was a little bit unusual then too. I mean, most of the sex was in some kind of, even if it was temporary, there was a belief on both people's part. It was a relationship at the time they had a sexual experience together. So, yeah. So I did a lot of helping girls make decisions about when they would be ready for a kiss. And then when they would, what kind of conversations they would need to have to want to do more than kiss. So,
yeah, those are some of the sessions that a therapist can have with a client, an adolescent that sometimes they can't always have with their parent.
Does this ring a bell with your work, Diana, with what you're doing now?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I work more with adults now. I don't work with adolescents as much anymore. I actually got pretty burned out in working with primarily eating disorders in adolescents. And now I work with their parents. And what I see in their parents and what I see in myself in my 40s is very much what you write about in Seeking Peace, which is the meltdown that people in their mid-40s experience and that you share about having experienced after you wrote Reviving Ophelia, of spending so much energy in an output in taking care of people or being the best, you know, parent, the most involved, informed, whatever parent, and then just crashing. And it's another dichotomy, you know, sort of the sex, either, you know, sex with people that you don't know or no sex with, I think with parents, it's either, you know, you're all in and you're over involved and you're putting all this energy into whatever career. It's a big growth time in terms of career. And also for times of change. I mean, I think women had careers. My mom had a career when I was an adolescent, but it's different now where women have careers, you know, women are running stuff and then also expected to be parenting at the same time. So tell us a little bit about the meltdown in terms of your confession, your chronicles of the worst Buddhist in the world.
Well, in Seeking Peace, I wrote about my life, but I wrote about it through the prism of becoming a very popular writer and doing a lot of traveling and speaking. I had 1 year, I spent more time in hotel room beds than in my own bed. And that didn't work very well for me. I'm a homebody. I like my cat. I like my friends. I like my trees and my fireplace. And I really, as I think this is a common thing, if you're someone who a lot of people are aware of, But as your public self becomes bigger, your yourself, your real self that's inside, sort of shrivels up from lack of attention because you're so busy responding to the needs that come before you as a public self. And what actually happened with me was it was with the middle of Everywhere, the book that came out right after 9/11. It wasn't doing well. I'd gotten a sizable advance. I felt a real obligation to help my publisher sell that book because I wanted them to not lose money. I've always felt that. I've always felt like if somebody paid me, I was going to do the job I was paid for. So I was out on the road much more than I usually was. I agreed to more work and more scheduling and so on. And I was out on the road at a time when people didn't much like to be on airplanes. And I ended up in November with a bad cold, flying to speak at a little college in Ohio. And we had three commuter little planes flying. We were in a snowstorm. We got off this plane. I'd been reading Fast Food Nation on the plane.
Oh, yeah.
And we were driving toward the venue. We hadn't had any food all day. So we stopped at the only restaurant that's available. And it's not good. It's got some dead flies in the window. But we go in. And I told my husband, I need to go home. I need to go home. I can't do this anymore. And we went through with the job. I spoke at this little college, and then we got back home. And fortunately, in the winter, I don't travel much. The roads are too bad. The planes are icy and so on. So I had 2 or 3 months when I didn't speak. And I didn't go to holiday parties that year. Didn't do much of anything. I lay in front of my fire and read history. History is a wonderful way to keep things in perspective. I drank a lot of tea, and I started reading a lot of Buddhism. When I read psychology, I read psychology at first, but it kept making me feel badly about myself. You know, it just kept making me think, oh, do I have an anxiety disorder? Do I have post-traumatic stress reaction, et cetera, et cetera. But when I read Buddhism, I felt very differently. I felt like what I was hearing was, you're in a community of sufferers, like all people are. We all suffer. That's part of being human. And I felt a connection to other people as opposed to the disconnection I was feeling. So I started meditating, and that was very helpful. I went out on the road again, but not so much. I set much stricter boundaries about the work I did and how much work I did. And I very much worked my way back to being normal. And, you know, I say it was a meltdown or a breakdown. It was a very polite meltdown. I don't think anybody knew about it but my husband, you know, because I just stayed home and was quiet for a while. But it was a good thing to do. And I wish anyone who gets in a position where they feel like, I'm in a spot I just don't want to be in, and I maybe can't handle it. It's starting to affect my blood pressure, in my case, my nerves. It's a great luxury to be able to just stop at that point and rest. And it's wonderful therapy. You know, a lot of the old ancient therapies really were just rest therapies. You send somebody to the magic mountain to sit around and look at the view with a cup of tea for a few months, and they got better. You know, it's a really good treatment.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's something about also removing you from this external self, as you described,
yeah.
Like as your external self got bigger, you were neglecting your inner self. And one of the challenges, I actually think a lot of people can, maybe you're not famous, but a lot of people can relate to that experience now,
yeah,
because of social media.
Absolutely.
Because the external self is something that people are spending a lot of time promoting and curating. And, you know, I have colleagues that have large followings on their social media, and I can watch them posting certain things, and then I'll call them up, and it looks like they're having a beautiful time with their family or whatever. And I'll call them up and I'm like, how are you doing? Oh, just terrible.
Yeah. Isn't horrible. That funny?
I'm so, you know, stressed out. And I'm like, whoa, wow, there's a mismatch here between what I'm seeing. And a lot of these things are planned out like a week in advance. Like they're not real time what's popping up on your screen. And that removal, that break to find yourself again and take a rest, take a beat.
Yeah.
I feel like that's talking about developmental stages. That's a midlife. It's very much culturally influenced. If you think about, you know, it's not something wrong with you or that you can't handle it. There's cultural influences in terms of that, but also a midlife necessity, because you feel like in midlife, you just feel like you don't have enough time. There's a feeling of time poverty.
Well, there's some really good, research that looks at mental health across time. And the age you are in, the mid-40s, is actually the hardest time in a human lifespan. And I think that phenomenon that you may be experiencing, some of your listeners may be experiencing, of just kind of hitting a wall and, boy, I don't know if I can keep doing this, is really common. The other common experience is a kind of an existential crisis around, is this the life I want it? You know, is this really what I had in mind for myself? And how many of my needs is it meeting? And so on. And those are big questions that hit about your age. Now, by my age, in contrast, most of my life's over. I've got a very little future and a great big past. And I don't struggle with that existential question of, is this the life I want? It's the life I've had, you know, and it's the life I mostly will have until I'm gone. But you're right in the thick of it, Diane. Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a feeling of responsibility at this age, of responsibility for your children to set them up well for a good life, and then responsibility to set up your future.
Yes.
You know,
yes,
well,
yes, yes.
You know, this is where the questions of purpose and meaning and all of that start to surface. And then things can feel meaningless when you're task mastering your day, you know, mm-hmm. you just kind of are going through the motions, whether, and also in your relationships, you know, as well. And so, yeah, I feel like the Seeking Peace book was probably most relatable to me, but the one that I guess gave me the most hope is the Women Rowing North book.
Yeah.
Because you are writing about aging and women and aging in a really different way than what we're taught as women about what to expect. I mean, we're all kind of worried that we're going to go gray and our boobs are going to drop and all the things.
Oh, man. The cultural messaging around older women is just terrible. Well, first of all, women my age are the happiest people in the entire human race. And I think it's because we've kind of figured out the coping skills we need to be happy. And of course, not all of us are. But at my age, one of the things that I said in Women Rowing North, if you don't grow better, you grow bitter. And it's very catalytic age for growth because on one hand, most women my age have more time and they're having extraordinarily good experiences with women friends or travel or creative pursuits or just so many wonderful things happen when time opens up. On the other hand, it's a time where children and even grandchildren are growing up in a way where there starts to be a regular amount of loss in every year. And so it's a challenging time. And the sorrows of older women need to be balanced by joy. And most of us seem to figure out that algebra and be able to do it. So one story I tell in Women Rowing North is I used to teach at the university and I'd swim down at the university pool. And I'd be in the locker room and all these young women would be changing clothes and they'd be so insecure about their bodies. They'd be all hunched over like this, trying to just not have anyone see any part of their body. And they'd also be making these negative comments about their bodies constantly. And then they'd be talking about, for the most part, stress, academic stress, stress with family, money stress, stress with female friends, stress with male friends. And a lot of times they'd be talking about looking forward to getting loaded on the weekends. Or they would be actually bragging about how drunk they'd been the weekend before, which was kind of a shock to me because women, when I was in college, women drank, but they kept quiet about it. They did not ever brag about it because women drinking is such a negative picture. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, when I switched to my gym for older women, it was totally different. The women are walking around in their old underpants and bras and joking around and laughing and totally relaxed about, you never hear anybody say anything bad about their bodies. They don't think about their bodies in that kind of evaluated way anymore. And they tend to be very nurturing toward each other and often talk about, for example, how beautiful the morning is or how excited they are that they're going to see a grandchild. But the tone was so strikingly different. And so it actually, I think if you ask a lot of people, would you like to go back and relive your life? They would go no, you know, because they're in a spot now where they realize how happy it's possible to be.
Yeah. I feel that way when I look at young moms with newborn babies. I appreciate them. I want to hold them for a few moments and just savor the little tiny hands, and but I don't want one.
That's right. It's like,
well, thank you.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
I remember how hard it was and how hard it was to enjoy it.
Yes, exactly.
And I see that shift in the older women that I work with in terms of what they do worry about and what they don't worry about anymore. And the freedom that comes from, in some ways, we're all afraid of becoming invisible, but there's a freedom in becoming invisible. In some ways. Yeah.
There absolutely is. And also, the invisibility means that nobody's paying attention. You can do whatever you want.
Yeah.
So that's a pretty nice thing, you know.
Yeah. I was giving a workshop with two pretty prominent psychologists last week. It was a full day workshop. And I woke up an extra hour earlier to blow dry my hair. An hour. Because I have a lot of hair.
Oh, honey.
And while I was blow drying my hair, I was thinking, I don't think that these men are spending an hour blow drying their hair before this workshop. Maybe they're spending that hour sleeping or, you know, enjoying a cup of coffee.
Yes.
Or,
yes.
And all the extra stuff, mm-hmm. that we do with the hunching over, putting our clothes on, the worrying, covering up our stomachs. I mean, how many women have sat on my couch with a pillow over their stomach?
Oh.
You know, these things that are just these subtle energy sucking behaviors that women engage in from adolescence through midlife. But hopefully we get a little more free in our 60s and beyond. So A Life in Light takes us into another realm. You know, we have Women Rowing North, which starts to give us hope for happiness as with aging. And then A Life in Light, I feel like it's sort of all of it put together. It starts, you share these. As I was reading it, the way in which you write makes you think about, what were my childhood pets? Or what are my memories of my grandmother? Or who were the people in my life that made me feel like I mattered? And those are some of the stories that you tell. And then also how we grapple with parents that are imperfect, but also start to have compassion for them that they were doing the best they could in the circumstances that they were in.
Yeah, I loved writing A Life in Light. And in a sense, I don't know if I'll write another book, Diane. It was kind of a benediction for me. It was kind of a way of saying to the reader, this is what I figured out about how to be happy. This is what I figured out. And you can figure it out too. You can have A Life in Light too. It's a question of intention or attitude and a set of skills. Happiness is an attitude and a set of skills. And I truly believe that if a person wants to be happy, they can learn the skills they need to be happy. And here's one little example. I believe that generally we find what we look for. So if we look for money, we'll probably find it. There's ways to make money eventually in this culture. If we look for prestige, we can probably figure out a way to get some prestige. But when I wake up in the morning, I actually spend at least an hour just getting ready for the day.
Not blow drying your hair.
I don't have to. My hair's just what it is. But getting emotionally ready, journaling, meditating. But I set my intention for the day. And sometimes I'll say, today I'm going to look for evidence of love in the universe. Or today I'm going to look for beauty. Or today I'm going to give myself plenty of moments when I just stop and pay attention. And those little setting of intention skills can make such a difference in a day. Like, for example, with you, Diana, you're very busy. You're very harried, I can tell. But if you could set your intention, for example, to have every day, could be a different intention, but to have something that gives you joy every day that you're on the lookout for, it would make a little difference in your day. And then, of course, the great survival skill at any age is gratitude. Just being able to be grateful for an interview with a person like you, or a sunny day, which is what we have today, or a good bowl of vegetarian chili, which is what I'm going to have for lunch at noon. All of it, you know?
Mm-hmm. So setting your intention and going with gratitude. And those are Buddhist principles too. Yeah. You can see that coming through in you. And then I also wonder about, how do we get to be 75 and have the health and the connections to be able to enjoy the time?
Yeah. Well, I'm not an expert on health, but I am an expert on friends, and especially women friends. And I see women friends as my mental health insurance policy. I've lived in the same town 50 years. And my husband's, we're both psychologists, so we know psychologists, but he's also been a musician since before I met him. So we have a musical community, and we have a writing community. And I'm in a sangha, so I have a Buddhist community. And then I'm an environmentalist. I have an environmental community, and I work with refugees. And I think a lot of my happiness is, I have these beautiful activities that I can be engaged in at any level I want. I try not to ever get to the point I wake up and look forward to a day with dread. To me, one of the real centering acts in the morning is to have my mind right so that I'm looking forward to the entire day with pleasure. Even the things that are difficult. Like, for example, who likes a dentist appointment? But I'll tell myself, be so grateful you have a dentist. Be so grateful you live in a time when your teeth aren't falling out or in pain. And that'll move me into a little bit different spirit about that. So.
For people that struggle with that, I mean, you've practiced this over a lifetime, but maybe for folks that are feeling depressed or they do feel that, wake up with dread.
Yeah.
And it feels false in some way. Sometimes gratitude can feel forced or false. Mm-hmm. Do you have suggestions around that? Like on the worst days.
Well, of course, everybody has worst days. And I wouldn't claim to be a pinnacle of mental health myself. I hope I don't sound that way when I talk to you. I have days that are very hard to pull things together. I mean, one of the gifts of my age is I'm not in a hurry. I don't have to pull things together quickly. If it takes me longer to sit and think and put myself together emotionally, I have the time to do it. I also, because I'm not working full time, have a lot more activities that are easy to enjoy, like walks with friends or tea with a friend or whatever. But generally, everyone can feel grateful for the gift of life. I mean, every morning when you wake up, you're breathing, you're alive, your eyes are working, your ears are working. You can taste, you can touch, you can smell, you can see. You can walk in most cases. All of these things are things to be grateful for. The sun's coming. That's something to be grateful for. all of it. And so even in the, it's not like privileged people are the ones who are the most grateful. It's actually people who are having the roughest times that are the skilled people with gratitude, because it's, they need it. They need it to be able to go out and face life. And so in Women Roy North, I interviewed a woman who had great many disabilities, very poor, worked at a difficult job as a telemarketer, had had a very rough life, all of her life, including she had just recently lost her boyfriend, who she was just crazy about. And she was the biggest laugher, the most grateful of anyone I interviewed. And just, she had the knack of knowing how to enjoy life. Now, these are things nobody picks up in one night. You build these skills over a lifetime. But what I argue in every book is it's not too late ever to build these skills. And I try to show people through my writing, I try to be a cultural therapist. I try to show people, here is what I know about building these skills. And some of them, some of what I write will be helpful to one person. Some will be to another, I hope.
Mm-hmm. I remember being an adolescent and looking up at my mom when she'd come into bed, and I'd be worried about something, and thinking, I can't wait until I'm 40, like my mom, and I'm through all this. You know, so it's over. And I can be like my mom and like wear what I want to wear and do what I want to do. And then now that I'm in my 40s, I look at 70-year-olds, and 70-year-olds like my mom doing it. She's has art and art galleries. She leads people on painting trips around the world. She has writing groups. She's involved in environmental stuff. And I look at her and I'm like, I can't wait.
We're the luckiest ones.
You are the luckiest ones. And there's, and then you also sit in a lot of wisdom. So you're at the end, like you've lived a long life, but you've, all of that has built it, has like seasoned you, you know? And so you're just like a good cast iron skillet. There's a lot, cook a lot.
Well, that's a very nice description of me.
So thank you. Thank you for your life's work. And it was really impactful for me as an adolescent to read Reviving Ophelia, but it's only just in this last little bit that I've started to open up all these other books, and I have a lot to learn from you. So thank you for sharing this. And
well, thank you. It's been a beautiful interview. I'm so happy to have met you, Diane.
Take care. With the light coming in on both of us. In today's episode, Mary Pfeiffer talked about their developmental life stages and some of the skills that we need to thrive and grow during those stages. She talked about the skills that you are developing and that as parents and caregivers and educators, we need to help our adolescents develop are things like helping them get to know themselves and build themselves and how to define for themselves what is their own North Star. We need to help our adolescents develop emotion management skills, which include things like perspective taking, as well as how to calm and soothe themselves. And our adolescents need social skills. They need to learn what their yeses are and their nos are, how to navigate sexuality, as well as communicate their needs. Mary talked about midlife skills, and she talked about when you find yourself in a spot that you don't want to be in and you can't handle it, that it's time to stop and rest. Take a break, take a beat, take a breather. And then finally, Mary talked about aging and skills like setting your intention for the day. What are you looking forward to? What can you give yourself today that will bring you joy? And gratitude, setting your mind right so that you look towards the day with pleasure. As Mary said, happiness is an attitude and a set of skills. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Your Life in Process. When you enter Your Life in Process, when you become psychologically flexible, you become free. Please join me as a member at yourlifeinprocess.com. And if you like this episode or think it would be helpful to somebody, please leave a review over at podchaser.com or call me at 805-457-2776. Email me at podcast@yourlifeinprocess.com. I want to thank my team, Craig, Ashley Hyatt, Yoko Nguyen, and thank you to Ben Gold at Bell & Branch for his original music. This podcast is for informational and entertainment purposes only, and it's not meant to be a substitute for mental health treatments.